You're listening to Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Episode 8, iBooks 2, Brace for Impact. So what did you do last week?
I don't even know. My debit card got compromised. That was fun.
Oh, shit.
But luckily I didn't lose anything. They called me like, hey, do you buy some stuff in Italy? I'm like, nope. Thanks, wow. Zappos. Which nice. Is where I have to assume, since Zappos gets hacked on Thursday, Friday, my debit card gets compromised.
Oh, I didn't even realize I got hacked. That's one of the larger online retailers I've never purchased from.
I thought I was lucky in that I'd only done PayPal, but I think most likely that someone just, you know, was able to take one list of things and another list of things, compare them and find a person's name and address and match it to a card they already have. I think that's likely what happened. I don't think Zappos cards got compromised, the card numbers, but the customer information did. So, yeah.
Anything new on the MakerBot front or your tiny walking eye?
Haven't worked on Twi this week other than I fitted out like some new hardware for sensors and controlling servos and stuff, and stuck his new brain inside, which is pretty awesome.
Brains.
And I wanted to play Robotron. I watched this movie called Chasing Ghosts, which is, if you've ever seen King of Kong, it's kind of like that and has a lot of
right
people.
On.
Yeah.
And yeah, then
I was like,
cool.
Jonesing to play Robotron. I was talking to my friend Mitch Hale and we were talking about stuff and I'm like, oh yeah, I bought this joystick. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to go play Robotron. And then I can't find the cable for my joystick.
But with Robotron, you need two joysticks anyway.
Right. So I built a joystick deck that has two joysticks, so I can play Robotron on my main box. So specifically, so I can play Robotron because I love Robotron. What have you been up to, sir?
My week has been crazy. Let's see. Last week I guested on guest is now a verb. I guested on Kanan Flowers' show, Scruffy Thinking, and that should be up certainly by the time this is up. So please look for it. So aside from being on Scruffy Thinking, I had a friend of mine come over from California, my friend Tom, who used to work for I'm going to screw this up because there are lots of Lawrence Livermore lab units all over the San Francisco Bay Area, and I always forget which one he works in, but he used to be one of the admins for one of the fastest computers in the world. So that is pretty cool. It's utterly fascinating, but probably very boring for other people. So we also had our first guests on the show. That was a lot of fun.
It was. Those guys are so much fun to talk to.
Yeah, and they were really polite and really wonderful, and they knew each other well enough that they had a really good pacing. So all I wanted to do was kick back and not say a word and just have them talk and say, all right, cool, 90 minutes done. Fabulous.
Yeah.
Let's go.
That was really good. I mean, yeah. And as a listener, I really enjoyed it.
Actually, for a few moments throughout the show, I forgot that this was interactive. I'm so used to hearing them on a podcast that I thought I was merely listening to them on a podcast. And of course I was, but except it was my podcast and we were recording live.
Right.
So definitely check out last week's podcast with Aaron Rabinowitz and Seth Worley. They were really fantastic. And definitely check out Red Giant TV, Red Giant Software. They make some really great stuff. And it was a pleasure to have them on the show. So this week's topic is iBooks 2,
ba-ba-ba.
Electric Boogaloo.
Yes, another ranty
yeah.
podcast.
But I think, I mean, there's a lot going on, right? So yes. Last week they had the whole keynote on Thursday, and it went over the new products that are available, which it was more than just, you know, iTextbook type of thing. It was iBooks 2, which was the container format for all the new textbooks. There's iBooks Author, which is an authoring utility that is on the Mac. There's iBooks Textbooks, which is a bit of a long, drawn-out name, but that's iPad only. Those are the new textbooks that everyone's talking about. And then there's the iTunes U app, which is both... It's sort of a weird hybrid of courseware and a bookshelf.
Right.
Which is a little bit confusing to me.
It's kind of like they pulled iTunes U out of iTunes and turned that into an app in a way. But it looks more like the bookshelf.
Right, yeah. It seems to me, if you're an educator, you have the ability to, I guess, download the iTunes U app, create a syllabus or some sort of, well, I guess it is a syllabus for lack of a better, but it's actually, it also incorporates quizzes and stuff like that in it as well, doesn't it?
Really, a lot of the iTunes U stuff, none of it's really new except for the app and the way it's now organized. I mean, a lot of the stuff that's in there was already there.
Well, the iTunes U stuff used to be video and audio podcasts.
Correct.
For the most part.
For the most part. Well, maybe I've missed this part of it. Is there more to it that I haven't seen?
So yeah, you can build courseware in it.
Okay, so they've added some sort of a syllabus
course with manager.
A checklist, basically.
But yeah. Apparently you can do some quizzes and you can do, you can assign all your books and your chapters and all that sort of thing. So you have an opportunity to, it's a bit more interactive, and it also is available on your iPhone as well.
Right. Yeah, I haven't fiddled with that part very much because I was spending most of my time looking at how it was reintegrating the content to the new, because it, you know, if you saw like the newsstand, it came out and it's like, oh, okay, it looks like iBooks. Oh, but wait, how do I find newspapers? And yeah, so I was kind of like exploring the how it works as far as if I was coming into it cold. And I ran into a couple of problems with like subscribing to collections is really difficult. Subscribing to a course is really simple. You go to it, there's a subscribe button. But if you have a collection, which is different.
a collection is a collection is a collection of courses, right?
Or a collection, I found just a collection of videos, for instance, for one course that was under collections, and I really wanted to get it and subscribe to it. So what I ended up having to do was download one of the videos. Once it was downloaded, click on it, click on the little gear, and then there's a subscribe button. But there was no subscribe button in the header of the actual thing, which was kind of annoying. So, I mean, there's still some weird things about it, but it looks really nice. It's nice to have all that stuff in one place.
I think the iTunes U courseware app is sort of interesting, except that as a non-educator, I don't have access to it. So it is really meant purely for the academic university or K-12 set.
Yeah.
So I can't do, say, corporate classware using it.
Right. And I think that's a choice they've made from the very start, was that this was really going to be very university-centric, you know, and they've done a lot of work with MIT and other schools, on that. I mean, maybe it will branch out at some point, but I think right now their model really is, this is a university thing, so.
It's interesting. I think it shows a bit of promise. I like the idea of having a dedicated app for iTunes U stuff, because I always found it inside iTunes to be a little bit annoying.
Right. It was an also-ran kind of thing.
And it behaved sort of like a podcast, but not quite like a podcast. And you couldn't access the iTunes U stuff in your normal database. It was sort of, off to the side kind of thing. You had to specifically select it. I view all my iTunes U stuff on my iPad, and so it always got lost. Like, oh yeah, I've got another one of these and I should really, read up on it or listen to it or watch it or what have you.
Yeah, it really did, I think, make a lot of sense to pull it out of there because it was a little bit disjointed. I understand that the reason it was in there like that was, we have iTunes and that's what we have. So let's shoehorn it in there. But I'm glad to see it come out.
I'm also wondering if that is shades of things to come with regard to iTunes, because iTunes right now is a very big, bloated piece of software.
Right.
It's synchronization, it's for not only music, but also calendaring and your contact information, all of your iOS devices, but also anything that involves downloading and buying music. But
yeah. I think we've already seen some of that change with, allowing, the Wi-Fi sync and things like that, kind of go ahead and moving away from it. From what I think the store iTunes will eventually just be the store. But, like you said, there's a lot stuffed in there right now that really needs to be pulled back out.
Right. And I'm also wondering if they must be thinking about this, because it would be silly if they weren't thinking about this. The sheer size of the iTunes music store, or the iTunes store, I should say, makes it nearly impossible to find something that you are not specifically looking for. So if you're not using the search feature and typing in exactly what you're looking for, you will not find it. There's just too much stuff, and the interface isn't really conducive to quality, serendipitous.
Right. They pinned all their hopes, I think, on Ping and the Genius tools. So yeah, we'll see where it goes from there now that those have kind of...
Yeah, that didn't work out too well. Well, I think part of the premise was that it was going to integrate Facebook and therefore have a lot more traction.
Yeah.
And that fell through.
That didn't happen. Right. Yeah, I think that really just changed the whole formula that they were planning. So
iBooks 2 is the reader, and that's just on iPad and iPhone. It's basically just an updated version that allows you to now play these new updated textbooks. The textbooks themselves are kind of interesting because they're iPad only. Right. So I'm wondering, it's like, well, what kind of improvements did they make to the iPhone version if you can't read an iBooks textbook on an iPhone?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, the whole thing. I mean, although presumably there were also bug fixes that were included, I would assume. But it does make you wonder about, you know, exactly what's going on. And I wonder also, will there be a desktop version of the client? And why not if there's not? I mean, because, yes, they want to sell iPads, but if they're really serious about this whole, you know, textbook thing, you're going to need to branch out just a little bit because, you know, people have to read their books.
So we also have the iBooks Author application, which is, as I mentioned, a Mac application, and that is the authoring environment for you to create these new iBooks textbooks. It's really an authoring environment purely for that.
Yeah.
The keynote made it sound like it was an application that allowed you to create these cool new electronic textbooks. They would be not necessarily a current standard format, but they marketed it as something that I think it isn't. And that hence the problem that I've got with this entire thing, which is ultimately I think that this is a lovely thing that they've done, meaning that I think it's a great new technology. I think that these new highly interactive textbooks are going to be really great. I think the people who are prepared to make them, to create them, will make a lot of money doing that. I think that they are ready to be received by the public, but it was marketed specifically toward the K-12, at least at the keynote, right? I don't see on earth how this really helps them if you need an iPad in order to use these books.
Right. And I mean, the whole idea that K-12 is also includes our public school system, you know, just really changes the whole tone of the conversation. When we're talking about iTunes U, we're talking about universities and higher education. It's a whole different can of worms. But when you start to bring public education into it, then the conversation gets much larger. And like you say, Apple has made a nice tool, but it's a nice tool to make textbooks for Apple to sell in Apple's store. And that's where it really just gets kind of dodgy.
Right. I mean, I think ultimately this is a really wonderful enabling technology. The big downside that I can see about this, and we tweeted about this over the last week, which is the schools that can afford iPads or have students that already have them and therefore have access to iBooks 2 and these textbooks, they will get further ahead. And the people who most desperately need these, they need the additional engagement, they need these additional technologies, they're the ones that also can't afford them.
And they're going to be left behind.
Further behind.
Right, so further behind, right, because they're also, one of the dangers is they're not going to be left with not a five-year-old textbook, but an eight-year-old textbook because everyone else has moved on. So, well, here's what you get, the textbook we have.
Right, this is the textbook you have, and, you know, it's not, and it's also not going to be replaced in the next 5-10 years.
Right, exactly. Instead of it being replaced 3 years ago, well, we kind of have to make it last longer. That's the danger that's looming.
You can even draw the parallel between adult society. So over the last 20 years or so, you know, the 1%, as it were, and I don't want to get all too political, but it's very clearly the same. Right, the analogy is clear for me, which is, you know, the 1% has created laws and created loopholes and tax structures and such like that to further themselves ahead of everyone else. So if you take a look at all the charts of, you know, how much more the executive board is making at a particular company versus their average worker, 25, 30 years ago, it may have been two times as much or four times as much, and now it's several hundred times more.
Right.
And this is the same thing. So in the town where I live in Greenwich, Connecticut, it's possibly one of the wealthiest towns in America and possibly in the world. There is no question in my mind that these kids will be able to have access to this, and they will be able to use them, and their scores will certainly get better. But if you take a look a few miles down the block, you've got Bridgeport, which is the exact opposite. So they are one of the poorest towns. They have some of the lowest scores in the state. I don't know about the US in total, but they certainly have some of the lowest scores in the state. And they are never going to afford these.
Yeah, I mean, it's creating a new minority in education. Now, stepping back, of course, there's probably someone yelling at us right now, you know, well, this is just the first step. And yeah, I realize this is just the first step. And hopefully, you know, things are really going to change soon. But the danger is that people begin to put their eggs in this basket and become beholden to this basket. And I am a huge Apple fan, but let's not forget what the market looked like before iPods and what it looked like after iPods. So Apple clearly can, you know, take a market and dominate it and change it, and which just can be great. It did things for us with the music industry that needed to be done, or it can be bad. I mean, and it's just really a matter of where Apple wants to go with it. And as you mentioned to me, you know, earlier, you were saying, well, people need to realize that Apple is a company out to make money, and don't, you know, hold them up to some, you know, pedestal. That's because what they are in the end is a company out to make money.
Right, exactly. They're specifically, you know, designed as a publicly traded company to make a profit. Luckily, they make a profit by creating products that we all want to buy because they're very compelling and very engaging, and they're well made. But when something like this that is marketed toward a very specific populace that spans economic strata and has a very profound effect on one of the foundations of this country, i.e. education,
right,
then that's something entirely different. Just because not everyone can afford an iPad or an iPod shouldn't matter. The problem, though, is that in this scenario, when we're talking about new textbooks and new technology that enables better ways of learning so students can more easily retain that information, then it very much does matter.
Right. And if anyone who hasn't really looked or read too much on this is wondering why, you know, where we keep saying it's all iPad, the authoring tool that they've released can only be used to make textbooks that work on iPads. And if they're sold, they must be sold through the iTunes store. So it's immediately cut off for anything other than iPads. So.
Right. Exactly. It's designed from the ground up to lock you into the Apple ecosystem, which, again, on face value, when you look at Apple as a publicly traded company, that's perfectly acceptable.
Right.
But when you are bringing in something that is not necessarily in the public sector, or excuse me, in the private sector like that, but rather public schools and such, then you've got something entirely different on your hands. I don't know the answers to that. I don't know how they can do the right thing, other than, you know, one could easily bring out the idea of, oh, well, you know, Apple's got $1 trillion in the bank. They can just buy everyone iPads. Well, actually, no, they can't, because that's dumping, right?
Right.
That's dumping product, and that's illegal. They cannot do that. You know, you can't dump a product for which you receive no profit in hopes to gain market share, which is precisely what that would be.
Exactly. And, you know, and something I mentioned earlier, or I think I mentioned in my notes, was that if this were Microsoft, we would be having a very different conversation overall, because people's immediate reaction would be that this is bad. A lot of people are saying, well, you know, it's Apple and it will help innovate. Yes, and it will. It will definitely get this ball rolling. And hopefully it'll light a fire under other companies that need to get involved now before Apple does roll over everyone. But, you know, if this was Microsoft, we would have be having that long about if it was their Windows tools or if it only ran on Windows phones and things like that, we would be ranting and raving a lot louder. So I think we have to eat our own dog food now.
The marketing of Apple products has always been, you know, it's the underdog and everyone loves to root for the underdog. But now they are clearly not the underdog. They haven't been the underdog for a very long time in any area that matters in this day and age. I would say that PCs, for the most part, yes, they still matter, but they matter less and less at every passing year.
Right.
And in the areas where in the areas of growth, Apple is dominating.
Right.
By a significant margin and is continuing to, you know, go faster and be better than everyone else, which on one hand is lovely because, they continue to make great products. On the downside, though, is that now they're starting to make the rules. And if you don't like those rules, then in some very real ways, you are potentially shut out of revenue.
Yeah, because that's the Apple way of the Apple back in the day when they weren't dominating. And I think people who are still comparing their PC sales as some sort of indicator are overlooking exactly what you're saying, that the PC is becoming less important. So it's more about the things that Apple does dominate in. So it really is a first time in a long time that we've flipped this in where Apple is doing something that we really need to be very wary of what the outcome is.
Exactly. I kind of want to take a look at the iBooks textbook, such a bad name, file format. It's .iBooks, which doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. But going through that, it's actually a zip file. So if you change the extension, you can actually unzip it and see what's inside. And what's inside is kind of EPUB 3, but it's got a bunch of proprietary extensions, which means that no reader that reads EPUB 3 will have any idea what to do with this.
Yeah.
And it's iPad only.
Well, that's understandable.
Right. But at the same time, you know, it's great that they're able to do that because that means that they've shed all of the, to be perfectly frank, bad open standards and they've created their new standard. The problem is that it would be nice to have it open. But again, it's not in Apple's best interest to necessarily make it open.
At least not yet.
Well, not yet. But you know what, though? I mean, there's a difference between, at least the way I see it, there's a difference between trying to make 100% of the money available, meaning that, you know, if that market is X dollars, you don't necessarily need to go for that X. You can go with, you know, some percentage of X. You can do 80% of X and still make a crap ton of cash. So why not make that file format open so that other people can read it or create content in that format, but have the best goddamn authoring software out there, have the best store out there so that people still sell it on your store, people still use your authoring tool to make it, but you're not getting all of the money that's available. You're just getting most of it.
Right. When you're making the best tool and you're going to pull people to your competing platform. If you're making the best viewer, you're going to pull people to your viewing platform. And it does benefit. And one of the things that when I said not yet, I guess in the back of my head, what I'm wondering about is, what happens when the government gets involved with this? Because it does involve public education. So at some point, you're selling this to the government in a way. Now, I know the whole idea is that you're selling the books to the children, but there is a fairly large and cumbersome and been around forever methodology for buying books for public school systems. So at some point, that behemoth is going to sit up and start talking to you, you know, and whether it's spewing fire or whether it's your best friend is going to be hard to say. And it's really going to depend on how Apple reacts.
There's only so much that Apple can do up front before suddenly, oh, wow, we're actually trying to sell these to the schools. You know, these boards, especially the public school system, you know, yeah, they're all run by the local governments. And they all have standards that must be upheld. I can almost guarantee you that those standards have not been updated for anything resembling something like an electronic text. that's interactive like this. I mean, right now,
it will have to be revisited, which is another can of worms.
Right, which means that they're now not a single school year out. They're now probably two school years out before they can even consider buying any of this, which I find very interesting.
And then at what point do they say, well, school system X is invested in all these Android tablets, so Apple, how are we going to get your book? Oh, but your books don't work on Android tablets. What do you mean? You know, I have an entire school system that has Android tablets.
Yeah, which means that it's EPUB 3 for them or EPUB 4 or what have you. Right. Now, I actually think the format's really great.
Oh, it is. It's wonderful. And it's what Apple does great. They take something, they look at it, and they see what's wrong with it, and they make it better.
Which is, you know, how they built Safari, right? It was KHTML for a while, you know, prior to that. That's the engine, which was a Linux-based HTML engine. And they took it as opposed to Firefox or what have you, and created something. You know, Safari is a pretty damn good browser, especially when you're talking about standards compliance. And obviously, everyone on an iOS device is using a form of Safari in their system. So they take a look at what's available. They will extend it, which is a lot like the Microsoft, you know, embrace and extend concept. It seems to me. Where they're taking an open standard and tweaking it just slightly to make it completely incompatible. But I think in this case, because the scope is so small, i.e. it's only meant to ever be on an iPad, the idea of being able to incorporate audio and video and imagery and even 3D models, which is fantastic. You know, you can actually import 3D models and have them lit and have them shaded.
Yeah.
There are quite a few bugs in that that we're actually encountering. We're doing some iBooks stuff at work. And, you know, just right now, we're just sort of exploring the possibilities, seeing what's available, seeing what's not available. And right now, there seem to be some bugs. They have two types of shading algorithms. One is a vertex-based shader. One is a pixel-based shader. And right now, they're optically identical. And they both look like the vertex shader. And if you've ever seen the difference between vertex shading and per-pixel shading, you realize that one looks like crap and the other is actually quite decent. And yeah, so it doesn't quite work out. And also, there are some weird lighting things going on as well. So if you're setting up your scene in whatever app that you're normally working in, 3D Studio Max, whatever, you know, you're going to set your lights at a certain brightness level. You import them, and it's all a complete mess.
Right.
Like the lights are way, way, way too bright. They don't make any sense. And so that's clearly a bug. So they're clearly working a lot of this stuff out. And you also mentioned that there were some weird bugs that you saw.
Yeah, here and there. I ran into some things. Some of them are just annoyances, but there are some bugs too. But another thing I was going to say about that whole embrace and extend, you know, it's like we have seen that with Microsoft, but if you compare like Internet Explorer to Safari, the difference is Apple will typically also embrace the standard so that Safari renders HTML5 very well as, you know, any extensions they add, whereas Internet Explorer has a history of extending things and then not actually adhering to the standard itself and not, you know, so that's one difference.
Well, that's a pretty serious difference as well.
It is a serious difference. And
massive.
It's one of the things, it makes it okay to like Apple a little bit more. But again, they are just a big giant company, you know. So,
right.
I guess some of the things that I have noticed, none of them are real deal killers. And I think I sent you my book today.
yes. I saw that book, which is fantastic. Lovely.
And I'm very curious about the rush to announce all this. That's really in the back of my head this whole time. It seems as though a lot of this is rushed. And I don't understand why.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you. In modern Apple times, where they have withdrawn from Macworld, they've withdrawn from all these public expos and that sort of thing. And the thought behind that was, well, that allows us to announce stuff when we have something and not before.
Right.
Which is, you know, which is a fantastic idea. You know, why?
Well, release it when it's done.
Right, exactly. Why would you rush something and potentially fake it or have something that's, you know, half-assed that may break when you're trying to demo it? For example, at CES, Intel was caught faking a game demo touting the new graphics capabilities of the new Ivy Bridge processor. They're saying that this 3D game was running on the hardware, and as it turns out, they were playing a video of it on VLC. So, oops. You know, you don't want to ever get caught in that position. You know, just simply don't announce it until it's ready.
Right.
So Apple's been doing this for a while, and here we have something where it's very clear to me that it's some of it's just not quite fully baked yet.
Yeah, even much so. I mean, and of course, I've obviously contacted some textbook makers to have them have content ready, and I, quite frankly, the McGraw-Hill books are a mess. There are errors in the math and the physics textbooks, and that's only the ones, you know, that I've looked at. And presumably the others have errors in them as well. Now, I will step back and say that if you look at the Pearson books, they're very, very good. And it's, I mean, like, very, very good. It's quite a thing to see, but the McGraw-Hill books should probably just be pulled down because they're bad. They have incorrect information in them, which is horrible in a textbook.
Or maybe it's just a bullet point where you see, oh, okay, well, this is an electronic textbook. You'll get the update in a month and everything will be corrected.
Well, in a month, you know, you've already learned this.
It's actually a feature.
Well, in a month, you've already learned that. What was it? They said, I don't know, amperes is it's a unit of a measure for one thing, and they were attributing it to an entirely different thing. So someone's going to learn that wrong.
Yeah, that's blatantly incorrect. Yeah. Well, the other thing I'm wondering, and this is really all about the publishers, this file format has the opportunity to be incredibly robust and interactive. These publishers do not have the capacity to fully engage this file format. So if that's the case, where they're not going to go in-depth with rich video, other methods of interactivity, then what's really the benefit of the e-textbook over the Dead Tree edition?
I think we're going to see who really has the guts in this industry too. It's clear McGraw-Hill is just stuffing existing content in there and getting it wrong in the meantime, where someone like Pearson has tackled the format. They've looked at it and said, all right, let's make something awesome. And they have. I mean, their books are really good.
Cool. I'll definitely have to check those out.
So, I mean, you know, especially for this is the first of these things that you've seen, you know. So,
right. You figure the first ones would actually be the showcase ones. You know, they're the ones that had the most lead time. You know, they're the ones that should have been, you know, like in the video game industry, you've got your launch titles.
Right.
You know, when a new Nintendo console comes out, better be damn sure that there's going to be a Mario game.
Right. Or a Zelda game.
Right. They're going to take a franchise that is always blockbuster, you know, AAA, super groovy title, and they're going to make sure that that ships with the console and it's going to be great. It seems to me that Pearson did a fairly good job. They did their homework.
Right.
Whereas the McGraw-Hill folk, maybe not.
Maybe not, yeah. I mean, they did have the E.O. Wilson's Life on Earth, which is really incredibly nice. But clearly Apple worked on that, I would say. Mm. So we'll just have to see. But my sneaking suspicion is we'll see a lot of what we've seen from, you know, like MPAA and RIAA, where there will be those who will not want to turn the ship. They'll just want to, here's the ship as it is, and stuff it into a new envelope.
Well, I do wonder about that, because if you take a look at the cost to make the Dead Tree books, right, and of course change them just mildly every year and charge, you know, more for the new revised version,
yeah,
you know, it seems to me that there's way more profit in that than there is in the e-textbook, or at least the iBooks textbooks, the way they've got the price structuring, because theoretically they're saying, you know, these textbooks have a maximum price of $15. But I'm also seeing a future where we've got in-app purchases for module additional modules. So, for example, you know, you get the first, they announce that on in the keynote where you can download this one chapter now, and then later on, when the new chapter comes out, you can pay, you know, $2 or whatever to get the new chapter. I can see a lot of nickel and diming there, and that's not really something I want in a textbook.
Yeah, and I think there's been a lot of people have been talking about this whole thing, and they've been mixing the university / college and the K-12 market together, saying, you know, kids, you buy your books and you sell them back. Well, that's a college thing. And then there's what I think a lot of people are passing over, the fact that a school district will buy a book and they will buy it, you know, in these huge numbers, and they will use it for 3 or 5 years, which is not the model that Apple is touting. Apple says a student buys one book and it lasts him a year. So, you know, and then next year, the student coming up buys that one book and buys it for a year. In the K-12 market, maybe the bookmaker is not making less money because, you know, if a book is $80 over 5 years or it's $15 per year, you know, it's a very different number. Now, in the university market, it's totally different. The whole buyback scheme does change. But I think what's important to talk about now, I mean, I don't care about the university market right now because it doesn't affect people, like talking about our public education and things like that does.
People in university, the entire paradigm is different. You go to university, you pay to go there. You may get subsidized through, you know, academic scholarship or what have you. But when you go, you are expected to buy your own books and pay for your education pretty much wholesale,
right?
Or as the case may be, retail. Whereas, in K-12, that's not true at all. You're going to have the books given to you, and you're expected to keep that book in pristine condition and hand it back. And you may be charged for that book if you ruin it or otherwise lose it or what have you. And that book is going to last many, many years. You know, it's returned at the end of the semester or at the end of the year. I mean, there are a lot of variables in this, right? So it may be $80 for 5 years. You know, it's assumed that a book has a five-year, let's say for sake of argument that a book has a five-year lifespan. And let's say for that sake of argument that the book costs $100 because it's round.
Yeah.
Is it more of a burden on a school system to outlay all that money up front, or does it make more sense to outlay the $15 per year per person?
And that's the other question. Are school districts going to be looking to the student to buy the book, or are they going to be buying the book? And if they're buying the book, do they get some of the book discount and things like that? These are questions that, you know, no one has any idea about how it's going to work out in the real world. Even the places that are already embracing iPads have not really sorted this sort of thing out to any, you know, huge degree. So,
well, they haven't even really been able to sort out general app purchases either.
Well, some of them, yeah, are doing some very creative things like buying iTunes cards and doing that. But yeah, the whole idea of the account is really, you know, a sticking point for them. And like you said, for university and college textbook purposes, you know, that really doesn't matter because that it is going to be attached to the person. But what if it's not attached to the kid, you know, and it's like, it really does get dodgy. And Apple has been very slow about addressing, I work in the educational industry. And
well, we've stated what you do in the past. So
yeah. Well, I work in education. I'm not an educator, but I work in it, and especially in technology. Sure. And Apple's been very slow to deal with that. You know, like when Lion came out, it was, you know, it was several months before there was a mechanism for, you know, universities to buy a Lion license, you know, versus right, an individual. So, you know, it's really, I just don't know how this is all going to shake out when it comes down to the dollars and cents.
The use case for Apple, the general use case is, you know, an individual owns a device.
Right.
Where in the K-12 universe, the individual does not own the device. The institution owns the device.
Presumably.
And that, well, right. And that device is shared amongst multiple people.
Right. So in theory, you've got, you know, high school science teacher with, you know, let's say 25 iPads, if you're in a really good class where there's only 25 people. And then, you know, they're putting the stuff on those things to teach science. And then, you know, and then they take them back But then again, how well do they take them back? Do they let students take them home? I've never really talked to anybody who's worked out a good model for that. You know, what happens when they walk off and things like that? Do you charge a kid $500?
Yeah, do they? I mean, I could easily see a situation where, okay, in class there are 25 iPads and you get in and you use the iPad for referencing your textbook, and then you leave the class, but you leave the iPad behind, and the next class that enters the room uses the iPad that you just used.
And except, now the notes are broken.
Well, precisely. So how does things like your personal notes and all of that, you know, how do you take that home? How do you take that home to study?
Right. So
if you don't have access to it.
Yeah, so that's what I was saying. It would be nice if there was a version either on the web, which would be ideal because then anyone could access it regardless of what their situation is, you know, as long as they have a computer or access to a computer, which would all, you know, they can log in and also bring up their notes and highlights and things like that. That would be great. But otherwise, like you say, it's one person per iPad. And that person is the canonical owner of everything that happens in it. You can't, you know, have secondary logins on an iPad. You can change, you know, like the count as you're doing things, but, you know, it doesn't change the machine fundamentally. So it's just kind of a whole dicey thing. You can't assign one student per iPad unless you have enough iPads for every student. It's crazy.
And these are hard questions, which undoubtedly Apple is working on.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're not easy to answer, unfortunately.
Right. These are the sort of things that I'm expected to figure out every day, and I can't figure this out right now. It eludes me.
Well, because the other thing is, as someone who works in technology in the education space, how on earth does this look to you where here is a proprietary format that is only readable on a particular type of device? Where does that put you in terms of, you know, fail-safe, reliability, all that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Albeit the best thing that Apple has done is, you know, instituting the whole you can re-download things, thank God. Because the first day a kid shows up and says, oh, I lost my textbook, you know. Well, download it again. So that's all but.
And it should take only a few minutes. But if you actually, theoretically, all your notes and such like that are stored in iCloud as well. So
or on the device, regardless of whether the app's still there. Well, no, that's questionable too. But nonetheless, I mean, you don't lose access to it. But like you say, I mean, there is a lot of this about the whole proprietary format and the device and yada yada that really puts a hard pin into the whole idea. I mean, I work at an Ivy League university, but a lot of our students, and people don't realize this, a lot of our students are there with scholarships, and they're also there with money that we pay them. We actually help put a lot of our kids through school. Everyone thinks that, you know, it's only rich people that go. It's rich people that help us be able to put these other people through school as well. Because we want prestige more than anything. So we want the smartest students, whether they're rich or poor.
So, well, I think that's actually one of the nice things about the more exclusive schools like Harvard and MIT and all that, that if you are capable of getting in, if you are in your top, you know, 1% of 1%, and you know, you do extraordinarily well in your SATs and you have an amazing grade point average and you do all of your extracurriculars and they absolutely love you, but you have not a radish, they will make sure that you get in.
We will find a way to pay for your school, even if you know, we're paying you to pay us. It, you know, we will find a way. But that said, you know, I don't have unlimited money and I can't go buy 60 iPads for my first and second year grad students. I just can't do it. I don't have 40 grand to just throw at, because iPads cost the same for education as they do for most people, regular people. So that's a lot of money.
You know, these are difficult problems to solve. I'm really glad that a lot of institutions are looking at it as something to solve, as opposed to discounting it entirely, saying, no, it doesn't work for me. Leave it alone.
Yeah, I just hope that enough of them don't just jump in feet first without, you know, really
assessing.
Because quite frankly, I think public education right now should stay the hell away from this.
Whichever, you're still going to swear.
Because, you know, things are going to change because, like I said, there's no competitor. And Apple's going to have to deal with governmental agencies and states, and they're going to have to deal with all this other stuff. So a lot is going to have to shake out. And there's no, you know, cross-platform things. And again, I know this is just Apple's thing. Well, if you don't like it, don't use it. But that's great, except for when someone makes a decision for you, which is, you know, what we do in these larger realms like public education. Someone has to make a decision. If they make the wrong decision, it affects a lot of people, not one person.
It's sort of disingenuous to even ask, rather to even make the statement of, you know, if you don't like it, then don't use it. Well, you know, again, if this is a massively groundbreaking, engaging technology that will allow students to learn better, faster, more, it is in society's best interest to allow them to access it, right? So,
right.
So there's a bit of a problem.
We want it to be better. We want people to be smarter. We want to compete. And if we don't have educated people, we will not compete.
Right, which is what, you know, a lot of people complain of, like, oh, you know, I don't have children, so why am I paying school taxes and why are my taxes going to schools? And I'm like, well, because that benefits society as a whole. You know, certain things are just larger than you.
Right. If you want a strong America, you need a smart, educated America, because you can't build a strong country off the backs of just a low working class and a bunch of educated elites at the top. And I don't use that in a derogatory term like you hear a lot on TV. What I mean is, when education is not available to everyone, only those who can afford it will be at the top. And that will never change, because those people will never not be at the top, and their children and children's children and so on.
Difficult problems to solve. And thank the gods I'm not running for office.
And in 2 years, we might be coming back to this saying, thank you, Apple, for kicking anyone's ass into gear.
Which is fantastic. Because I personally think this is a fantastic opportunity for someone like Amazon to say, hey, you know what? What Apple did with this proprietary format of taking an existing standard and making it suck a lot less, well, we can take that one step further. We can make it even better. We can create our own standard that is as interactive, and right, then make it an open standard.
And the next thing you know, this iBooks supports that new open standard, and everyone can see the same thing.
And everyone wins.
Yeah.
And wow, isn't that a lovely thing? You know, Amazon, considering all the Kindles, considering that they sell so many physical books, you know, they sell a lot of university textbooks as well.
Right.
You know, and I imagine that, although I do not have any information to back this up, but I imagine because they also sell university textbooks, they probably have the capacity, or maybe they do, have the capacity to sell to the K-12 market, because their prices are probably going to be better than through the publisher directly, simply because they can buy in much, much larger quantities. Now, there may be problems with that, because each state is different. And
right, it's going to vary state to state and then district to district. But some districts may have that autonomy, or may have that built in. And sure, and those are the book distributors, the book warehousers, wholesalers are the ones that are going to start feeling the pinch first on this, you know. So there's a lot of impetus to see things. Well, you know, if they want to make some money, they're going to get involved in the other side of this now, because the old model, it's completely broken. It's very expensive, and it's not going to work in this new world that we live in. You know, we live, like I said in my notes, we live in the 21st century, not the 19th or 20th century. So let's get the hell on it.
Indeed. With Amazon's Kindle hardware, or even the Kindle software, I imagine that if they update their software to enable these paginated, highly interactive books, you know, they will certainly have a winner, because there are far more people engaged on the Kindle platform. And by Kindle platform, I don't mean just the Kindle hardware, I mean the Kindle software, because they've made their software available for every conceivable platform you can think of. I think they'll win.
I mean, because you can read your Kindle books on your computer, or on your Kindle, or on your laptop, or whatever, on your Amazon Fire, or on your Android tablet. So, yeah, I mean, that's a huge...
On your desktop.
You know that they are furiously looking at this right now. I mean, because quite frankly, the Kindle Fire is not the tablet for me. And I love my iPad, and it's a great piece of hardware, and I love it to death. but the Kindle Fire as a textbook reader could be pretty good, and it's only $200.
I think that's where things start to get really interesting. Now, they've got a lot of hurdles to overcome that Apple doesn't have, because Apple's scoped their output to the iPad.
Right.
You know, they have to deal with different screen sizes and different resolutions, certain hardware problems, the direct touch and gesture interfaces versus a mouse and a keyboard.
The Amazon doing everything kind of half-assed.
Yeah, there is that.
Or halfway. I shouldn't say half-assed. Just right. Halfway, and then, okay, there it is. We'll talk to you later. if they can get over all that, which I think is certainly doable. I mean, it's a tall order, like you said, because there's a lot you have to, you know, just like PC software makers, you know, you have to take into account a lot of things that you're not dealing with as you're writing it about, which you are going to deal with in the real world, different hardware and so forth. But
But if you even take a stand and say, okay, we're going to create this new EPUB format and it's going to run on Kindle Fire, and it will run on desktop, laptop. You're pretty good to go there.
Right, and it's Amazon. And quite frankly, I mean, like I say, well, we're Apple fans, but if you go to a school administrator and you throw down two names, you throw down Amazon and you throw down Apple, I'm thinking most people are going to lean towards Amazon because they're our bookseller.
Sure, exactly. You know, it's funny. I don't have any of the statistics off the top of my head, but you know, obviously Amazon started out as a bookseller almost solely, and then they branched out to selling pretty much anything that you can buy over the internet. And so therefore, I don't know what the percentage of books they sell over everything else. I do imagine it's fairly significant, but I would imagine that the everything else far exceeds the amount of books that they sell.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's funny to have everyone still think of Amazon as a bookseller when really they sell pretty much everything.
Right. But they still do have a lot of contact with, you know, with the book industries. You know,
they certainly have more pull than Apple.
This is a case of where if this were a commodity that I was interested as an individual in buying, I would totally be in Apple's camp. But as an American, I'm totally in some more of someone like Amazon's camp, who is going to, you know, Amazon or Google, who are going to try to push things to the masses. And if anyone makes a socialism joke, I will pop them in the face.
Their marketing is clearly marketing the greater good. And I don't think that they're hitting the greater good. And again, they're a company. They're under no obligation to do anything involving the greater good of humanity,
right, exactly,
or America or whatever. But they're clearly marketing in that way. You know, they have all the pretty pictures of all the happy students. You know, in the reality of situations, that's not going to happen soon. I hope it does happen. And I hope it happens in such a way that everyone has equal access to it. But right now, that is not the case. I'm more in the camp not of Apple versus Amazon versus Google. I'm more in the camp of openness when it comes to access to technology,
right,
and equality. You know, right now we've got a massive, massive problem in these schools, which is, you know, the poorer schools have the lowest scores and the highest dropout rates and the lowest rates of continuing education beyond K-12, and the most wealthy schools have the highest test scores and the most ability to move on toward university and graduate school. We don't need a technology that will create a bigger chasm.
Well said.
Thank you. it's the one thing that really scares me. I think it's a tremendous, wonderful technology.
I mean, and some people might say, well, you know, what about them? But, you know, that's no way to make a great country, because what you're doing is you're creating a class of people who can only fill a certain amount of those lowly jobs. And then the rest of them, you either have to take care of, or you have to be this heartless, you know, person and say, screw them and let them, you know, I don't care what happens to them. And either way, you're lowering the viability of your company, which is America Incorporated, to compete on this global market. And we are not the powerhouse we have been in the past. We can't ignore these kind of things, you know. So it's very important. Yeah, maybe it's not just about throwing money at education, but it's certainly not about either taking money out of it or making things where money is important to it in this way, such as not being able to afford this particular device and these particular books and things like that. So, it, like you say, it's scary.
Yeah. Oh, I do want to circle back to the iBooks Author application, because I've been playing with it again for work, testing it out and doing some fun stuff with it. As a matter of fact, I'm looking at it as not necessarily for academic purposes, where I want universities or K-12 to, you know, use and check out my books. I'm thinking of it in alternative purposes. So things like manuals. Remember when software came with manuals, physical manuals, and then they came, you know, everything came on CD-ROM, and there was a PDF manual, which was basically an electronic version of the printed manual. And now there's no manual at all. There's an online help system, which is, you know, kind of dodgy at best. Some of them are certainly better than others. BB Edit's help system is pretty good. Adobe's suite is not too bad, but the vast majority of them out there, they don't even implement the standard macOS help system. And so that's just really not good. But now you can ship an iBook for free with your product.
Let me tell you why I think this is such a great idea. Because I think in the end, what it does is you know, industry will put money into things or spend time to make them better. And if you make the tools better for this thing that makes these books, then the beneficiaries are the people who are using it for an academic space. And I think it's a great idea. And not only that, it benefits, you know, industry, corporation, and even just individuals. And which brings me to the fact that today I was looking at these textbooks. This is not exactly the same thing, but I'm looking at this algebra textbook and I'm thinking, I was really bad in algebra. And I was like,
yes, we figured that out two episodes ago. But neither of us could do simple math. That was really embarrassing.
But I'm considering getting that textbook. And just, you know, sitting down at lunch and brushing up on that kind of thing. Yeah.
And totally.
It's you know, it's not just a new tool. It's trying to increase the density of information, but in a better way. And that's what, you know, it's like a focusing of information as we refine what the internet is and what that means. You know, we thought it was going to be the web, but it turns out it's not all the web. It's lots of times it's applications and devices. And I think what you're talking about would be a great thing.
To your point, there was recently, I think it was a Pew study, Pew Research, they stated that as far as internet traffic is concerned, more internet traffic is coming from apps than coming from traditional browsers these days.
Right, because you can't do everything in a browser. It's not what we thought it was going to be, and it really makes more sense if you have like, you know, well, like iBooks, you know.
Right. I mean, the point is that the web, as in the HTML, the CSS, a lot of people conflate the web and the internet. I have always made a very, very big distinction between the two.
I agree.
And, you know, the web kind of sucks.
Well, because you're beholden to a single app, the web browser. And if you need to turn a web browser into a book reading app, well, you're limited by it being a browser, so... You know, and we've rediscovered that in the age of the app, and which is, it's really kind of turned around a lot of this misguided thinking. So.
Right, which is really great because now we have the opportunity to have native controls with the automatic updating capability of the internet.
Right.
You know, we have the ability to download additional information ad hoc. So, for example, right now, Photoshop has the opportunity to go out onto the internet and find stock photography. So if you need an asset, say you're making a comp or mood board or what have you, from within Photoshop, you can go out into these stock photo houses and download proxies and put them in your comp. Yeah, here we have an opportunity to have a traditional desktop app that has all the native features, has all the speed, but is enhanced with an internet connection.
Right. Like SketchUp has, you know, their model warehouse or things like that. Yeah. I mean, it really is a better way of thinking of it. And we, you know, I was in the web camp for the longest time, and I still believe that there's a lot of things that we will still use that for where an app could be used, but where it makes more sense to use web, you know, because we need things like we need to get to our calendar or things like that. You know, that still makes sense in for a web browser. But a lot of
I was going to say, I think the calendar is not the best choice in that, because you also need offline reading capability.
But when you're stuck at, you know, in library and you want to check your calendar, I mean, the fact that you can get to it on the web, now it's still, of course, going to be, you're going to use your phone or your whatever to actually put things on your calendar and whatnot. But I think the web is important for the ubiquity when you need something to be ubiquitous.
It
makes sense.
Oh, yeah. It's the lowest common denominator.
Right.
And I think that's a great way to look at it, where, you know, if all else fails, you know, ideally we'd like you to have this data in our app for some purposes. And of course, that can go too far, right? Mm-hmm. Where, for example, every broadcaster wants you to download their own app.
Right.
And I'm like, you know what? I don't need, you know, a separate app for every television show that I care about.
Right. I need a TV app, not, you know, a TV show app.
Right. And of course, the broadcasters aren't going to have any of that. They will fight you tooth and nail to try to make one that, you know, a user can just have access to everything. God forbid, you know. Apple has a history of iMacing, making certain things, going forward almost a little too far into the future before everyone else is ready. So when they brought out the iMac, for example, they got rid of the floppy drive. They got rid of all the legacy peripheral ports. Right. So you were left with USB and no floppy whatsoever. So you just had an optical drive. I think that, and they did that with Final Cut Pro 10 as well, or Final Cut Pro X. You know, they leapt so far ahead and got rid of a lot of legacy stuff that the industry still desperately needed. I'm worried about the current iBooks format. For example, iBooks format today will work on my original iPad. It'll work on the iPad 2. What happens when the K-12 people, you know, maybe they get all the iPads and they're all iPad 1s or all their iPad 2s. Down the line, eventually the iBook format updates and suddenly new versions of the iBooks format can't run on the old hardware.
Right. It's like we've now integrated this, you know, a higher HD video because these new iPads have this amazing screen. Oh, but your first generation iPad will not be able to play this video, you know, or something like that. Yeah, that is a concern because they do like to push. They like to push you out of the carriage, you know, where you may not be ready, but they think it's time for you to get out. When they do that to something, like we said, that's, you know, that's more important to a broad society, that's where it really gets dicey, you know. To an individual, it's one thing. But when it's the iMac, okay, fine. You can buy a USB, external USB floppy drive. But when you're talking about, you know, our education system, it's a whole different story.
Yes, precisely. If you take the analogy one step further, there is no external education system.
Right, exactly.
You can't simply go to Fry's or go to Best Buy and pick up a USB external education system
right.
and plug it in. By no means do I think Apple is trying to be evil or mean or what have you. I think they are bringing this stuff out in hopes that it will be used for good.
But
right now, the industry isn't necessarily ready for it, and so therefore it doesn't know how to even necessarily ask the questions that Apple can then begin to solve.
I know, you know, there's potential for a couple of scenarios where Tim Cook is either sitting there going, well, we think this is important and we think this is great for the world. Or they're sitting there going, well, this is going to work for a while, but we're going to light a fire into everybody's ass and get them moving. Or third option is, let's make a lot of money. It's all, and like you say, the whole thing is just incredibly up in the air because of so many questions and answers that either can't be asked or can't be answered.
So where can we find you?
You can find me at maggiemcphee.com or on Twitter at TANKGRRL. What about you? Where can we find you?
You can find me on the Twitters. That's probably the easiest place to find me. I'm at Octothorpe, OctoThorpe. You can find me at localtype.org. Other than that, it has been another episode. So see you all next week. Bye-bye.
Remember to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Music for Ruining It for Everyone provided by Kevin MacLeod.
Well, it didn't make a damn bit of sense, did it?
Sure, now we've got cat noises we're going to tack onto the end of this thing.